Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Over 30% of Americans are now obese. Two-thirds are overweight. The average American woman is now a size 12. And the country's not sure what to make of it, what to do about it. A big chunk of Americans have just settled into their new sizes as the norm. Big, even fat, is on TV shows now, in ads, magazine spreads, store shelves, and certainly on the street. Other Americans rage against the trend, and healthcare experts warn the country simply cannot afford it, that the estimated $147 billion spent last year on obesity-related illness is unsustainable. This hour on Point, big as the new normal, and how we deal with that. It's in the air, it's everywhere these days, certainly on television, a new kind of acceptance, even celebration, of heavy Americans. Here's a promo for the Fox reality dating show More to Love. A female contestant talks proudly about her plus-size body and admires the hefty guy she's after.
I think I'm hot, and I'm not going to change myself for anybody. My junk in my trunk. I got a lot of it, and I love it.
He is a hottie!
He's big and he's a hottie. She's big and she's a hottie. In the Lifetime network comedy Drop Dead Diva, the main character dies in a car crash, goes to heaven, returns to earth in a bigger body. In the first episode, her best friend is incredulous.
Let me get this straight. You died, went to heaven, pressed a button, and they turned you into a size 16?
Pretty much.
That is so unfair. I mean, fat things should not happen to skinny people.
So unfair, but the show ends up celebrating the size 16 woman. As a country, we've got sort of cross currents in our culture right now on weight that are very powerful. We're going to look at them in this hour. Joining me now from New York is Kate Daly. She is health and lifestyles editor at Newsweek.com. She edited a series called The Fat Wars for Newsweek and has been closely following the debate over weight. Kate Daly, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
What's going on, Kate? How do we get to this place where we are bigger than ever, a lot bigger than just a decade ago, and so conflicted about it, part of the culture really accepting it, kind of moving into these genes, and the other part saying no, no, no?
Well, it's funny because even right there in that intro, there's a lot of controversy in what you just said. There are some people who are saying, you know what, we're not bigger than ever. The metrics we're using have shifted. You know, people really aren't fatter than they used to be. We're just paying much more attention to it because we do know that the research talking about obesity as a crisis really only picked up about 10 years ago, as you said. But whether or not people are actually getting fatter is another question. And whether or not people are, you know, I don't think it's something where we had a bunch of people who are size 4s or size 6s, and suddenly now they're size 16 or 18. What we're seeing are people who are born heavier, who grow up heavier, and who stay heavier. And there's a growing number of people, especially as the rhetoric around weight loss has really heated up and gotten, in some cases, very nasty.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who have said, you know what? Diets don't work. And I've spent, you know, my entire adult life or since I've been 14 years old trying to lose the weight. It's made me miserable. And you know what? I'm not going to focus and be obsessed with my body. I'm going to pursue other hobbies. I'm going to find movement that I like. I'm just going to eat things that appeal to me instead of seeing food as the enemy. And if I get thin, I get thin, but probably I'm not going to get thin. Probably I might be healthier, but I'm definitely going to be happier.
And that's the acceptance path that we see reflected in some of these television shows. I mean, there may be a fatsploitation element there, but there's also a kind of acceptance. We see it in what Glamour recently had, plus-size models all over its pages. You know, you've got plus-size models writing their biographies, celebrating their size. And to my observation, just in the street, you have Americans who are maybe bigger than they used to be, and don't think twice about it. They just think, well, this is what I am.
Right. Well, and it's also very hard. I mean, the problem with obesity is that it's a very visual affliction. There are probably a lot of skinny people walking around who have the belly fat that's going to lead them to get heart disease, but you can't tell because it's hidden under their shirt. And there are fat people walking around who probably have very good health markers, but you see someone on the street, you can see their fatness in a way that you couldn't see diabetes, in the way that you can't see other conditions that might one might associate with poor health. So what you have is this culture where we're able to look at people on the street and immediately think that we know all about their health and all about their lifestyle, when in fact we might be seeing a 250-pound woman assume she's unhealthy, not realizing that she kayaks every weekend, or not realizing that 6 months ago she was 300 pounds, and now due to her weight loss, she's much healthier, but she's still fat.
But we're going to hear in this hour from all sides here, but including public health experts saying we can't afford this, that the health consequences of being overweight, that's 66% of us now, being obese, that's about a third of us now, are just too wide and too expensive for the country to handle. $147 billion just last year, I'm reading here, Kate.
Right. Well, and again, I mean, I think that there are a lot of markers for poor health, but I would say that we have an inactivity crisis rather than we have an obesity crisis. That's what my research seems to be indicating. And it's the type of thing where if people start picking up healthier habits, we're going to reduce that burden of disease, but people might not be thinner. I mean, the idea that you're going to take people who are 300 pounds and get them down to 180 seems really unrealistic with what we know about body shapes and body sizes. And that also seems kind of counterintuitive to what the public health goals are. At the same time, this increasing rhetoric against fat people is actually costing us money too, because we found that people who feel discriminated against are less likely to practice healthy habits. Because if someone tells you that you're disgusting over and over again, you're going to tend to believe it and maybe give up. And women who feel like their doctors either discriminate against them or only see their fat are going to be less likely to go and get routine test procedures, things like screenings for cervical cancers, things that are going to prevent illnesses down the road that are going to help them be healthier. And so that will end up costing us money as well.
Which do you see mounting faster, Kate, the rhetoric against fat people, as you describe it, or the acceptance of heavier Americans, being that so many Americans are themselves heavy?
Well, and that's funny because a lot of this rhetoric, and the rhetoric is increasingly nasty, which is why we did that series called The Fat Wars at Newsweek, because every time we would post an article about obesity, we'd get hundreds of comments, and a lot of them were very, very, you know, kind of outright rude. And I was curious as to why people were so angry at fat people. And so that's been there. That's been there for about 10 years where people are really lashing out. It's getting a little bit more heated, especially as the healthcare debate ramps up.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you're sort of seeing a slower but a stronger progression of people saying, you know what, enough is enough. And I'm doing what I can to be healthy. I'm doing what I can to live my life. But I don't look thin in my jeans. And that's okay.
And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's not worth spending my entire day obsessing about how I look and what I eat.
I want to hear from one of those voices right now. With me in the studio is Leslie Kinzel. She administers the blog Fatshinista.com. She's been in the realm of fat activism and social justice politics for more than a decade. Leslie, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
So how do you see it? If there's a race on between acceptance and rage against, or, you know, at least rejection, who's winning?
I think it's complicated, really. Mm-hmm. I think you had referenced More to Love, which was a show that I recapped on my blog. Fox TV show. Basically, you had a fat gentleman and a bevy of fat beauties mm-hmm. from whom he was to choose a bride.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially sort of marketed as a fat version of The Bachelor. It was
right.
Came from the same
and why not? Because this is our country.
And a lot of, you know, sort of a lot of within fat acceptance circles, a lot of the criticisms were, why does it have to be a fat guy and a bunch of fat women?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, why not a slender guy? Because
mm-hmm.
there are, you
right.
know, guys who aren't fat who, you know, don't necessarily have to date only thin women.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's a powerful conflict going on here. I personally try to be optimistic and I try to be a glass half full kind of person.
Right.
But I look at shows like More to Love and I feel like on the one hand, they look on the surface like we're moving toward an area where we're going to be more accepting of larger women. But then the show in actual practice was really problematic. I redubbed it Fat Chicks Crying because the whole show, I mean, pretty much was fat women crying about feeling inadequate, crying about not being able to find a boyfriend, crying about all of their fat pain.
Even though everybody in the cast is heavy.
This is what was baffling to me because the show was first marketed as
mm-hmm.
see these wonderful, beautiful, mm-hmm. self-confident, plus-sized women,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's not what we wound up getting. We wound up getting, and I don't know if this was an editorial choice. I tend to believe it was. I think that the producers of the show were probably trying a little too hard to make these people sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably afraid that it would turn into a freak show of, you know, watch the fat women catfight.
But how can we be a fat nation, which we are increasingly are, and an anti-fat nation at the same time?
We have a lot of internalized self-hatred. We project the things that we dislike about ourselves onto other people. When you see a fat, not you personally, obviously, but when you see a fat woman walking down the street, it's very easy to look at her because you don't know her. You're not actually seeing her as a person. You're looking at her and thinking, she's completely out of control. I could never be like that. And there's a constant, particularly among women, with men it happens too,
yeah,
but particularly with women, there's a constant comparison going on between bodies. That's something we're raised with as women. That's a part of
almost instinctive.
It's
somehow
almost instinctive that, you know, we're going to compare. There was a study that was done jointly between some American researchers and some German researchers that had women, overweight women, look at pictures of regular size models and plus size models. And they found that both were equally damaging to the self-esteem of overweight women, that plus size models made absolutely no difference in how bad these women felt about
mm-hmm.
themselves after looking at these pictures.
Mm-hmm. Can read this country both ways right now. Fox aired this ad we're going to hear a little bit of during its NFL Sunday broadcast last week. It's cartoon versions of Dallas Cowboys in the locker room making fun of quarterback Tony Romo for dating Jessica Simpson.
Man, I still can't believe Tony dated Jessica Simpson, even after she blew up bigger than Flozell Adams.
Unlike Tony, at least Jessica comes up big when it counts.
Bad sound there, but you get the idea. It was pretty raucous. Fox apologized for it afterward. The character goes on to say, hey, Tony, is Jessica around? We could use a defensive tackle. Of course, she's not, I mean, she is what she is in her cutoffs, but it's hardly over the top. And she tweeted later, you know, what's up with this country? Why can't we just be happy with who we are? That theme we heard on Good Morning America recently. They were profiling the fat acceptance movement, depicting it as a backlash to the celebrity diet culture.
It's a fad that's all the rage among celebrities, losing weight seemingly overnight, only to run the risk of gaining it back. But while yo-yo dieting is a way of life for many, it's being sworn off by a growing number of Americans, including Marianne Kirby. She may tip the scales at 319 pounds, but when she looks in the mirror, she likes, make that loves what she sees.
When I look at myself in the mirror, I see pure awesome. Fat is beautiful.
There it is. Fat is beautiful. Two sides, you know, on the one side, derision, on the other side, acceptance. In the middle, a whole lot of Americans with plenty of pounds. Let's hear from our callers for a minute right here. Putney, Vermont. Drew, you're on the air. What do you think, Drew?
Oh, hi, how are you doing today?
Pretty well.
Well, you know, I just like to make the point that all this emphasis on how women look puts such a toll on them mentally, physically. Just growing up with a younger sister, hearing stories of girls, you know, putting their bodies through hell just to fit into that pair of jeans.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have the images that you see in magazines and on TV of these bones, you know, stick figure models walking up and down the runway. That's got to be horrible for their, you know, self-esteem as well as, you know, how they see themselves in general.
So where do you find your sympathies in the end, Drew? I mean, on the other hand, there may be health consequences for that weight, for them individually, for the country.
Oh, yeah, of course. And, you know, that's what I think people should just be comfortable with the way they are. Yes, there's a distinct line between being unhealthy and being, you know, and being, you know, happy with yourself, of course. I mean, if you're going to, you know, treat your body as, you know, most should do, as a temple, you know, keep it healthy, keep it energetic, but also be happy with yourself. I mean, there's just so much out there to do and help, and there's people to, you know, call and organizations to help. You know, there's a lot.
Live
to
in it.
There.
Be happy with it. It's you.
Exactly.
We've got it, Drew. Leslie, how do you respond to that? Are you a accept whatever weight you are person? What about the health issue there? Or is it more about just, you know, here I am. I'm alive. This is me. Let's go.
I really think that today we're living in a culture in which fat people are actively encouraged to hate themselves and to hate their bodies. And that creates an enormous amount of stress. And facing discrimination, as Kate said before, from outside quarters also creates stress. And all of that has health costs as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we also live in a culture in which the bodies of fat people are considered public property and sort of open season for comment, which is why when you have Jessica Simpson put on the woman must have put on maybe 10 pounds.
Right. I mean, come on. You know, this is hardly off the charts.
Yeah. We feel entitled to comment on that. We feel like it's our right to be angry at her for failing.
But don't
failing.
We comment on everybody now? I mean, the internet is full of images of everybody this way, that way.
We absolutely do. But I think a lot of it comes from celebrity culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us, we generate this sense of entitlement when we're talking about celebrities. And then when we start looking at the people around us, we feel like, well, I can, if it's acceptable for this to be said by someone on a media,
mm-hmm.
you know, show on television,
mm-hmm.
then it's certainly acceptable for me to make snide comments about my coworker when she's out of the room. I feel like it's sort of a trickle-down cultural effect. And I mean, as I said before, mm-hmm. discrimination and stress has its own health costs.
But Kate, I'm looking here at a photograph from the last month's Glamour magazine. It's a whole collection of plus-size models. Now, again, these are hardly like super Rubenesque, but they're bigger, way bigger than the skinny, rail-thin thing that's been the norm.
Right.
And here they are. They're nude and beautifully positioned, and they look great. And they're in the Glamour magazine.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, the caller made a really good point, because I think when thin is our focus and we automatically associate thin with healthy, you have a lot of people doing very unhealthy things to get to that point. And we've seen research that on college campuses, as people have been more concerned about obesity and not getting, you know, gasp fat, more people, more young women especially, are getting disordered eating. And so they're doing everything they can to not gain weight. And as a result, they're becoming much less healthy. And this includes, you know, skinny people and fat people. Like, there are a lot of fat people with eating disorders, which is definitely not healthy. And they're doing more damage to their internal organs in this sort of endless quest to be thin. So seeing people of different body sizes, I think, in the media is really helpful to realize that fatness or any shape, you know, if you've got a belly roll, if you've got short legs, if you don't have a neck, that there's not one standard of beauty to which we're all trying to whittle down to.
But what about the vision we saw?
Like different things.
Yeah, Kate, last year in the film that got so much praise, the animated film Wall-E, you probably saw it and you remember, this is somebody in Hollywood's vision or fear of a whole culture that became so overweight that all they did was sort of fly around in spaceborne barca loungers that, you know, they couldn't even stand up to brush their teeth. It was just the fear of a fat nation no longer vigorous, healthy, and sort of in charge of its destiny because of weight. What did you think of that?
I mean, I thought WALL-E was sci-fi, and it was a cartoon, and I know that it really upset a lot of people who felt that it was discriminatory. It was kind of a farce. And there's some research that indicates that you are the weight that you are, and that if you weigh 98 pounds and you're 5'6", it's going to be very, very difficult for you to put on weight and become obese. And we all know that. We all know the skinny people who can eat whatever they want and never gain weight. And we know there are some heavy people who, no matter what they eat, can't seem to lose weight. So there's increasing evidence that our weight is set either very early in life or, you know, before we're even born, and that is the weight that you are, and that even if you wanted to, you couldn't get very fat if your body wants to be thin.
Yet we see global numbers of the overweight, the obese, way up in recent years. You may dispute those. We'll talk about that. But, I mean, something's changing here. You can just look around, look at old movies compared to now. There's the difference. Nita in Boston, you're on the air, Nita.
Thank you for taking my call. I could do 4 hours myself on how I feel about this. Let me just make two points. The first is that I don't think it's a culture of self-loathing. I think we have a culture of entitlement. And if someone chooses to make choices, if someone chooses to put things into their mouth that causes their body harm, I resent that my health insurance is so high because I have to pay for people that have perfectly good bodies issued to them at birth, and then they put nothing but crap in it. And they have cholesterol problems and heart problems. Adult onset diabetes is directly attributable to causes such as alcohol and not giving your body good food. That's the first thing. Secondly, we have a crisis of lack of movement in this country. And the Obama administration is talking about making longer school days to make us more competitive. There's plenty of studies that have shown that increased exercise will drive up math and science scores. And you want to talk about the stress that's caused in people by having to look at these thin models? Well, exercise is also fantastic.
Nita, let me ask you something. I'm looking at a news story just out in the last couple of days out of North Carolina, saying that in North Carolina, state employees may be asked to pay extra for their medical coverage if they're overweight. Are you on board with that or not? You mentioned premiums.
I'm on board with that if their eating choices have caused health crises. And yes, there are people that, I mean, I guess the experts, some of your panel members are suggesting that there are 300-pound people that have perfectly healthy cholesterol and hearts and all their blood panels are great and they're not a burden, but I don't think that that is where the majority of our 300-pound people are.
Nita, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. I want to bring another voice into this conversation from Washington. We're joined now by Kenneth Thorpe. He's the Robert Woodruff Professor and Chairman of Health Policy at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, Executive Director of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease. Kenneth Thorpe, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You pitched in to the Newsweek series that Kate Daly edited, and you're painting a pretty dire picture of the health consequences of overweight America. How do you stack that up against the calls for acceptance and let's drop the self-loathing that we're hearing this hour?
Well, it's just, first of all, it's a very fascinating discussion, and obviously it's a very difficult issue, both personally and for society, I think, to grapple with. But if we just look at the numbers, then we can talk about some options here.
Okay.
It is interesting that for 30 years, between 1960 and 1990, the share of adults that were clinically obese, using the same standard measures, didn't change. And really starting in the late 1980s till today, it's doubled. So it's gone to, as you mentioned, 34% from 17%. That was, you know, persistent for a long period of time.
That's to obesity, not overweight. Overweight is 65, 66%, something like that?
Yes, right. So just the obesity part of it.
Well, so and that's who we are. What is that? So what?
Well, I mean, what we know about that doubling is that a third of the growth in healthcare spending between 87 and 19, in the early 1990s, is directly attributable to the doubling of obesity. Okay. The explosion of diabetes, hypertension, bad cholesterol, pulmonary disease, asthma, back problems, comorbid depression, all of those directly linked to this explosion of obesity, and it's cutting across all age cohorts. It's kids, it's middle-aged adults, it's seniors. So it really isn't limited to a particular economic strata or to a particular age cohort.
And the health consequences, you're saying, for individuals and the country, and you write in Newsweek, we can't afford, and yet this is who we are.
Well, it's the key driver of, along with technology, it is the key driver of rising healthcare spending. You know, put it in another context. Suppose that we had a magic wand, which, of course, we could never do, but if we magically could have done nothing but kept the share of adults that were obese at 1980 levels, 17%, our country would spend about $250 billion less today on health care. So, you know, I think just laying the facts out is important. How do you approach it is a controversial issue, but there's no question that this explosion of chronic disease prevalence that we're seeing among kids, middle-aged adults, and seniors is directly attributable to these rising rates of obesity.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Leslie Kinzel, how do you hear this public health line of thinking on a fact of life for millions and millions of Americans.
Well, one thing I would like to mention is the fact that in the 1990s, the CDC actually moved the goalposts between overweight and obesity, which means a lot of people went to bed one night overweight and literally woke up the next day labeled as obese, simply because they changed the cutoff. Obviously, that influences
numbers,
how exactly the percentages. And we literally did. We did have a big jump in obesity, but it wasn't because people got any fatter. It was because the goalposts were shifted.
Hold that thought for just a second. Ken, was there just a kind of a numbers game here?
Well, there's been some shifts there, but the numbers I'm quoting are our own calculations, not based from the CDC. They're based on survey data that the Department of Health and Human Services has collected, where nurse practitioners have gone in for now well over 40 years using the same protocols and weighed and produced measurements of height. And we used a consistent standard in our data and analysis to define the obesity, which is a body mass index of 30 and above for that 40-some-year period. So the definitions may have something to do with how CDC reports it, but it has nothing to do with the fact that obesity has indeed doubled.
What about the cost issue that Ken Thorpe raises here?
I actually agree that we have a health crisis in the United States today, but I don't think it's directly related to our fatness, whether it's increasing or not. I think it's related to the fact that we've become an incredibly sedentary nation. I think it's related to the fact that many of us have no real idea about nutrition and about how to prepare whole foods and about how to make healthy choices. These are things that, I mean, we talk so much and there's so much hand-wringing about how do we solve the obesity crisis. The reality is there is no magic bullet that is going to make fat people thin. We don't have one. Diets have a 93 to 95% failure rate, depending on the study that you read. Even weight loss surgery results in some loss of body weight, but it doesn't make people skinny by any stretch of the imagination. Lacking that magic bullet, talking about how do we solve the obesity crisis, which I use the word obesity reluctantly, talking about solving that is more about, we need to talk about how we can resolve the health issues that may or may not be arising around the same area.
Maybe wrong to focus on that one framing. Kate Daly,
exactly.
What about this approach? You hear the public health guy here. He says we can't afford it. Right framing, wrong framing?
Absolutely. Well, I think that that's a really good point. And I do like the idea, as Nita said earlier and Leslie said now, that we're not having an obesity crisis as much as an inactivity crisis. And there was a great article in the New York Times Magazine this weekend where the writer Dan Engber said, well, what about shortness? What about the shortness crisis? Because
if we were just taller, our body mass index would work out better at our weight.
Well, no, I mean,
there was
being short is also associated with you're more likely to have diabetes, you're more likely to have cardiovascular disease. And there's also some indication that shortness can be affected by early childhood nutrition. And it's really interesting to see the reactions people are having to that article, because it's echoing a lot of what I think some people in the fat acceptance movement are saying. I mean, people were horrified and they were saying, you know, I'm 5'2", but I'm incredibly healthy and I run. And
lay off,
you know,
short people.
Right, exactly. But I do think this idea that going by visual cue to judge people's health, it could get us into trouble.
The Obama administration may be the leanest in a long time, but up in New Jersey, there's a governor's race on. It came out in September as an issue. The incumbent, John Corzine, ran an ad implicitly directed at his opponent's waistline. The ad showed challenger Chris Christie stepping out of an SUV in extreme slow motion, focusing on his extra girth.
If you drove the wrong way down a one-way street, causing an accident and putting the victim in a trauma center, would you get away without a ticket? Chris Christie did. If you were caught speeding in an unregistered car, would you get away without points? Chris Christie did. In both cases, Christie threw his weight around as U.S. attorney and got off easy.
Going after a political opponent with the camera on the girth, Corzine caught a lot of grief for it. He's in 5-10K races almost every week in New Jersey, one of the country's leanest states. Trying to make an issue of it didn't exactly work out. But here's some more from the Good Morning American series on fat acceptance. Here's a young woman who believes she's healthier at a higher weight.
At 220 pounds, 22-year-old Gabrielle Gregg can relate.
Her blog, Young, Fat, and Fabulous, is dedicated to weighty women in pursuit of fashion. After trying dozens of diets, from Atkins to the grapefruit diet to Weight Watchers, she now believes there's nothing wrong, and actually a whole lot right, with being overweight.
I think health is not just about your body, it's about your mental and spiritual well-being. And I know at a lower weight, I was actually the sickest I've ever been. I was losing hair. I was having night sweats.
There you go. Fat acceptance, big and proud. Kate Dealey, where do we go with this as a country? We've got the population. It is what it is. We've got some costs attendant to that, and a lot, as you write, a lot of emotion around it. Where do you see us going here?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's not good for the soul of the country as a whole if we keep going down this path where we're sort of have this incredible hostility towards fat people. Because, as you mentioned, I mean, some numbers indicate that we might, you know, we may be getting fatter, or, you know, chances are the research shows that people who have struggled with their own weight tend to have more problems with the overweight. So it really is a mark of self-loathing. And again, it really takes the focus away, as Leslie said, from being healthy. You know, when you focus on just being thin or fat as being evil, you take a lot of steps that to get to thin that maybe aren't healthy and that are ignoring sort of the larger issues of eating more nutritious food, getting exercise that does good things for your body, and instead you're skipping meals, you're taking diet drugs. And so I think we need to have a more realistic view of what it means to be healthy.
Kenneth Thorpe, can we separate weight and health?
Well, it's hard to do, but I do like the point that was just made that, you know, there are solutions here, and I think that the issue is to point out programs and interventions for people who want to change and eat healthier and lose weight and enroll in effective diet, exercise, nutrition programs. We know that there are good programs that school systems are now using, which is a major problem. I mean, we've had the rate of childhood obesity go from 6 to 17% in a very short period of time.
1 in 5 4-year-olds obese, you write.
And, you know, if you look at, there's good community-based interventions. Employers increasingly are putting in good programs. You know, again, the ones that work there are voluntary, but they provide tools for people who want to change behavior to do so. So we can do this. We've done this with smoking. You know, we had smoking rates in this country in the 1960s well over 50%, and they're now in the low 20% range.
But we've turned smokers into a kind of pariah. As hard as dropping smoking is, dropping pounds may be harder. I mean, I don't hear you, you know, when you hear about fat acceptance, are you just, I hear you shaking your head and saying no, but there's plenty of people saying yes.
Well, again, I think we do no good by blaming people and making people sort of feel guilty and a victim. I think that the way to do this is to point out programs at work. There are well-established randomized trials that have been conducted from the National Institute of Health that show specific types of diet, exercise, nutrition programs are effective, particularly in focusing on a group we haven't focused on, which is people who are overweight, to prevent them from getting obese. And that's one of the major targets that we should really focus on. So we just need to find ways to provide information, the opportunities, whether it's in the community, the workplace, in the design of how we do health insurance, for people who want to change their behavior and want to lose weight and want to be healthier, that we can find avenues and channels that they can do so. But I think pointing fingers and blaming people is certainly a very ineffective and way to do this, and certainly is one that's not going to be work very well.
Leslie, your blog is very good on these issues. Can we thread the needle here somehow? That is, acknowledge health implications without, what do they say, hate the sin, not the sinner. Maybe sin is the wrong metaphor. I'm sure you would say it is the wrong metaphor for fat. But, you know, accept us, ourselves, the country, and yet work on the health issue that may be attendant with overweight? Or are you saying, just back off, just let the heavier be heavier?
I think it's complicated, and there's a lot of layers to it. And I think one of the biggest problems that we just heard from Kenneth Thorpe is the idea that this is all related to people's individual behavior, that fat people are, it can always be tied to their behavior, the reason why that they're fat. And I generally hesitate to use myself as an example because it's anecdotal data. But speaking for myself, I weigh in the area of 300 pounds, okay. And I have all of my blood panels have been normal for years. I have no health problems. I'm active. I spend 2 hours at the gym 3 to 4 days a week. I eat primarily whole foods, mostly vegetables. I'm not a big meat eater.
Right.
I technically, by most people's standards, do everything right. And I haven't, my weight has not changed within a couple of pounds over the past 10 years.
So this everything is, right, and 300 pounds, this, and you're saying, come on, what?
Which is why I argue so passionately that mm-hmm. there are people, am I normal amongst 300 pound people? I don't know. Probably not.
Is it a family thing? Is it, does it appear to be genetic for you? Or do you
personally,
know?
For me, I actually was put on my first diet when I was 9.
And so you've been around that track.
I've been around that track many times.
Right.
And I spent most of, you know, my formative years when, you know, a lot of kids are you know, learning to ride a bicycle mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. you know, making crafts. I spent dieting and being obsessed with trying to lose weight. And as a result, you know, I didn't stop dieting until I was around 18, starting when I was 9. As a result, my priorities and my weight went up and down and up and down.
That's
and
a,
up
that's
and
a hellish
down.
Mindset it's to spend a, your entire youth in.
And I think it's really, this is part of when we talk about fat kids and what can we do about fat kids. I am particularly passionate about the idea of this is an area where we have to tread so carefully, because the things that we do to children and the expectations and the shame that we put on them for their bodies can be so dangerous to them that they could spend half of their adult lives trying to recover from that.
But if the diets we introduce them to and if the exercise patterns we give them are such that we condemn them to being heavy mm-hmm. when that with negative consequences attached as well, that also appears like something bad to do to kids, I would think.
I think that kids, I mean, a lot of this I sort of tie to the fact, as I said before, this yeah. inactivity crisis, that we're not, parents aren't as active mm-hmm. as they might used to be. Mm-hmm. I grew up playing outside constantly every night of the week. I don't know many parents who let their kids go out from, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 o'clock at night and run around and play hide and seek in their neighborhoods anymore.
Not so much.
And you know, we're all so busy. We don't get to cook. We don't get to, you know, prepare the meals that would be nutritious and that would be best for us. And I'm not saying parents should feel guilty, but there has to be a common ground. There has to be a way to bring in these healthy behaviors and teach kids healthy behaviors without making them feel shamed by the fact that they might be, you know, 5 or 6 pounds heavier than, you know, the kids in their class.
Let's get a call right here from Brantford, Connecticut. Gina, you're on the air, Gina.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, this is absolutely wonderful to hear Kate, Leslie, Kenneth, and you talking about such a crucial issue. I have a private practice here in Connecticut. I treat girls with eating disorders. I treat women. I also treat men. I do mm-hmm. treat anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and also binge eating disorders mm-hmm. and also obesity.
Okay.
And I'm calling because some of the things you're touching on are so crucial. And one of the things I wanted to stress, because I do specialize in body image, is that body image differs from objective fact. It's really not physical. It's about how you experience yourself, including all the experiences you've had. Physical, tactile, kinesthetic, auditory, visual, every experience. So when one tries to alter and change themselves, they really need to have a clarity about what they are and not a distortion. And what tends to happen here is that we get out of our bodies and more into our heads with these diet ideas that are all about measuring, calculating, and weighing.
Mm-hmm.
Get very into the numbers, and people get away from that sense of what they really are.
But let me and ask you then, Gina, because you've got clearly a good handle on this, because we have our public health guys saying, you know what, the numbers matter. If you're too high up in these numbers, you've got a health crisis as a country that he writes, we cannot afford. Yet as individuals, we have to live with ourselves every day, and you can turn it into a psychodrama that's insoluble. So how do you thread the needle?
He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And we need people to keep an outlook, keep a big eye open for how high those numbers can get and how low those numbers can get, because the extremes are very dangerous. However, women and girls can live, and all people can live in their bodies if they have an attitude of acceptance, which is not resignation, which is not giving up, which is not separating themselves from social situations or denying themselves opportunities, whether it be in a physical arena or a work setting. All of these things are available to people if they are able to feel good in and about their body. If one person is taking care of themselves and they know that, that food will transfer into mood. Food and mood is very much about regulation, emotional regulation, and they will have that. So he's right, because it is dangerous. There is need for treatment at a higher level that will cost. But if we work on what Leslie is talking about, Kate's stressing, really getting into letting go of the shame,
mm-hmm.
and being present, full of noticing, empty of judgment. It's very much Eastern Western philosophy combined.
Gina, I appreciate your perspective and hear it loud and clear there. Kenneth Thorpe, you're listening as well.
I am, and I appreciate that. I think that I think she's largely right. And I just want to go back to a point I made earlier, is that in addition to just focusing on people that are already, you know, meet the clinical thresholds for obesity, I think it's equally important to really focus on people that are pre-diabetic, overweight, pre-hypertensive. That's the population where we know programmatically we can intervene and really make sure that people don't cross those clinical thresholds and hit full-blown diabetes and hypertension. So it's both sort of focusing on the population that's currently obese, but recognizing that every year we have a half a percentage point increase in the share of adults that are obese. So we have people that are moving up in the weight categories over time, that there's opportunities, again, programmatically to intervene, and that's a population that we could focus on as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kate, I hear you there.
Yes, and I think that Gina made a really excellent point, that when we talk about the fat acceptance movement, at least from what I understand in my reporting, it's not necessarily about giving up. It's not the idea of saying, well, you know what? I'm already fat. Let's pop open the donuts. What are you going to do? Mm. It's saying, you know what? Instead of focusing on being thin as the end-all be-all and spending all of our time focusing on that, let's get ourselves healthy mentally and physically. So let's just abandon the idea that we're going to lose weight and then refocus our lives from that point and find activities physically, you know, find physical activities that we love to do, eat foods that make us feel good, and really think about what it is that we're eating and what our bodies want to eat, rather than having very complicated relationships with foods, then binging and purging and feeling guilty afterwards, and really take this approach at making ourselves very healthy, but recognizing that we might always be fat. So it's not necessarily about giving up. Instead, I think it's kind of a much more healthy way of changing your standards so that you can live a happy and healthy life without being so focused on the scale.
But Ken Thorpe, I get the sense in what you're writing and others that we may be facing a real kind of crisis here. I mean, President Obama, of course, he's a pretty lean guy himself, mm-hmm. but he's saying we have a crisis in health care costs. Almost everybody agrees with that. Could sort of sink the country. If obesity is a significant element in that, and the clock is ticking, I mean, we want to handle this in the most sort of generous and fully human way, but are we up against a kind of an imperative with the cost of health care?
Well, I think we are. I mean, it's important to recognize, I'll just give you a statistic. Obviously, not everybody who is obese has diabetes and high blood pressure.
Right.
About 14% of adults who are obese are being treated for diabetes. About 4% of normal weight adults are being treated for diabetes. Problem is that if you look at the drivers of cost, diabetes is a great example. We've had an explosion of diabetes in this country. It's gone up 60-70% in a very short period of time, and almost 100% of the increase is due to changes in the distribution of body mass. So it is a major public health issue, and it's a major cost issue. I agree that the solutions are really more on the real simple diet, exercise, nutrition, eating healthier, and we just need to find ways to give adults and kids the tools to do that in the places where they are, the schools, communities, and workplace.
Leslie Kinzel, last word goes to you today. We just got half a minute here, but as we work through, you know, these are our lives. We're in it together.
I honestly think the most important thing to take away from this is that good health is subjective. A person with fibromyalgia is going to define feeling healthy differently than a cross-country runner. And I think that it's not so much that anyone is opposed to people being healthy. It's more being opposed to a homogenized definition of what health is for everyone. Because different people have different bodies, have different needs. Some people will be fat and healthy. Some people will be thin and unhealthy. That's how it is.
Sticking out the turf and sticking to it. Clearly, we're not going to resolve this one in 1 hour, but it's really interesting and a big issue for this country. Leslie Kinzel with Fatshinista.com. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Kenneth Thorpe at Emory University and the director of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease. Thank you for being with us, Ken Thorpe.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And Kate Daly edited the Fat Wars for Newsweek. Kate, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.